turn now to the price of oil. A year ago, oil had spent years at roughly $100 a barrel, down from the terrifying levels of the 2007-2008 period, where analysts were speaking of $200 barrel oil with confidence. While those high prices have financed new capacity all over the world, and analysts are now speaking confidently, of course, of $60 or $50 barrel oil. OPEC and the Saudis could stop this slide and stop your temporary contentment at the gas pumps, but last week they said they would keep pumping. Are they trying to stimulate the global economy? It could use it. Or squeeze the Russians and Iranians, maybe force some breakthrough in Ukraine, Syria, or an Iranian nuke deal? Get all that? Well, which is it? Stimulus or irritant? Professor Jason Bordoff, who is the director of the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University. Welcome, Jason. So, which is it? Irritant or stimulant?
Well, at first, I think we should avoid ascribing intent to OPEC's inability to reach a decision. So it's not the same thing to purposely decide you don't want to cut production. Many members of OPEC do want to cut production. They're facing very significant strains on their budget. They would like higher prices. But because they're facing strains on their budget, they don't want to be the ones to cut. So they'd like everyone else to cut. And the Saudis, Saudi Arabia, would be the ones to do the most cutting. They're the country that is willing to hold production capacity in spare reserve for the most part. So everybody sort of looked at someone else and said, you do the cutting. I don't want to. And the Saudis said, we're happy to do a bit of cutting to support prices, but we want the pain to be shared equally. And they were unable to reach agreement in large part because some other players like Venezuela, like Iran, like Libya really are under severe fiscal strain right now and were unwilling to pull production off the market.
Russia's the biggest oil producer. It's not in OPEC, right? It doesn't have a vote in this.
It's not. And the Saudis were pretty clear that they wanted to see some OPEC and non-OPEC participation in pulling back on production. And as you said, the Russians, depending on how you measure it, the world's largest crude oil producer. But their budgetary break-even numbers are over $100 a barrel. They've seen a sharp collapse in the ruble even before the sharp collapse we're seeing today.
It's
because of economic sanctions, among other things. So they're under severe fiscal strain right now.
Yeah, don't hold rubles, or they're going to be a bargain pretty soon. What's the record? I guess we haven't seen the ruble this low since the late 90s.
Yeah.
What about the price of oil itself? The consequence of $120 barrel oil for a period of time is that more oil is going to come out of the ground. Oil that was once not considered economically viable becomes economically viable. That raises production. Where do you think it'll settle?
Well, it's always perilous to try to predict oil prices,
as we've seen from just the last few months.
But look, I would suspect that oil prices are going to be in a sustained low range for the next several months at least. You know, whether they'll stay in the 60s or not, you know, I suspect next year we'll see them come up again into the 70s or 80s. But, you know, it's reasonable to think they're going to be in that range for some period of time. And as you said, that's way below where they have been for the last two or three years, where they've ranged somewhere between 105 to 115.
So this a world of difference between the settle price being at 80 and the settle price being closer to 60 or 50, right?
A very big difference. A big difference for consumers, because every $10 drop in the price of oil adds maybe 0.1, 0.2 percentage points to the growth rate of GDP. So this is a huge tax cut that the American consumer has just gotten. It's also a big deal for producers. And the U.S. now, again, is a major producer, too. And so when you start to see prices drop to closer to 60 than 80 or 90, on the margin, that's going to affect investment in U.S. shale production. I still think U.S. shale production will grow, but we would expect to see the growth rate decline.
Now, you say U.S. shale production. That ties in the whole Keystone XL pipeline issue and the shale production up in Canada. The pipeline is supposedly needed in the Gulf to refine products, the demand for which is falling, right?
Well, yeah, and Keystone is for the oil sands in Canada, which
is
slightly different. But that also requires a high price to produce the Canadian oil. The U.S. oil boom in Texas and North Dakota has come from shale formations, the sort of fracking, the same kind of technology that's given us a natural gas boom. So, you know, there's huge demand for that kind of oil to refine in the Gulf Coast. And the U.S. is still a net importer of oil. We still consume more than we produce. So there still is demand. There's a quality issue with the kind of oil we're producing here, which is why the issue of oil exports has gotten some attention recently. And you would expect lower prices would boost demand, right? It's also a stimulus to the U.S. as well as the global economy.
So you don't see anything here taking the wind out of the sails of either opponents for the Keystone XL pipeline or the supporters of that pipeline. That issue is sort of a wash here at these price levels.
I don't know if it's directly implicated. You know, the lower prices fall, the more challenged Canadian production will be. But if you think about a pipeline investment as a very long-term investment that's going to be in operation over decades and decades, I don't know how much a near-term drop in the price of oil affects how one should think about it, whether you're a supporter or not of the Keystone Pipeline.
What was the last real peak?
Of oil?
Of oil.
Well, I mean, 2008 was this incredible volatility where it went up to 140 and then it dropped down to $40 again. So we saw a great deal of volatility. And that followed these concerns about peak oil in the mid-2000s, you know, where was the next barrel going to come from? And partly in response to high prices and the incentive to earn more revenue, people invested in new technology that's partly been responsible for the oil boom.
And that's the next question. They also invested in new technology in their cars. They invested in new technology in terms of energy consumption around the home, heavy machinery, that sort of thing. How has the consumption rate changed in Europe and in the industrialized world in the sense that we're more efficient users of oil and that will have an effect on the swiftness of the bounce back, if there even is a bounce back here of oil prices?
Yeah, that's certainly true. And that's not just a recent trend. We've seen that over the last several decades. So the oil intensity of the economy continues to decline. The economy continues to get more energy efficient, partly because people have an economic incentive to reduce their consumption because it makes good economic sense for businesses and for consumers, and also partly in response to policy mandates like CAFE, fuel economy standards. So in the 1970s, we pushed oil out of the power sector, so we mostly don't use it to generate electricity anymore, and then over time, more and more has gotten squeezed out. It gets harder as you sort of move along that cost curve. The next barrel of oil to move out of the economy is more costly than the last one. But certainly, the more we can do to reduce oil consumption, that's the best way to boost U.S. energy security.
So bringing OPEC to its knees, making Vladimir Putin feel pain, forcing the Iranians to the table on a nuclear deal may simply be a matter not of sanctions and big power politics, but an army of Priuses that shows up on the shores of these three nations. Jason Bordoff, director of the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University. Jason, thanks so much.
Thank you.